I like this notion. It's a trip that you're taking, and you are trying to take the listener with you, and you go many different places. And that's what an album has always been to me. I think it's always interesting to see where someone whose music has informed you. It's like, what does this album say about who they are in their life?
Welcome to the second episode of One Story, a conversation with singer-songwriter Mary Chapin Carpenter, celebrating the release of her new album, The Dirt and the Stars. I am here with musician, songwriter, and legend, Mary Chapin Carpenter.
Well, I am here with poet, author, educator, and amazing person, Sarah Kay.
When we originally conceived of this podcast, we had planned to record in a traditional recording studio. But like so many things, the pandemic and sheltering at home changed those plans. So we recorded these conversations in some improvised settings, as I was sequestered with my family in New York City, and Mary Chapin was at her home in Virginia. So you should know that I am speaking to you from the couch in my little brother's childhood bedroom, and I was told that the best sound option is usually either literally in a closet or kind of buffered with clothing. And so I have opened his closet, which I'm pretty sure he hasn't opened in a decade. There's a baby chair that I have my computer on. Behind me is a virtual, almost a museum of Michael Jordan paraphernalia. And Mary Chapin, you're also in a pretty amazing space.
I started out in a closet, but it was too far away from the internet signal in my house. So that wasn't going to work. So I brought it down to the kitchen table. I'm actually sitting at the same chair where I write songs.
Oh, amazing.
The exact same spot. So I just gravitated to the spot, and I knew I just needed to create like a completely soft fiber cubby hole, you know, just so there's no reverb. I have a big duvet over my head and just tablecloths and wool blankets surrounding me with just one little sort of spot to sort of tuck my chair in, and my computer's inside. And it's very cozy.
It's like a blanket fort.
It's very cozy.
When I think of the book publishing world, it strikes me as very slow. Mm. Like you write a book, and then by the time you get to talk about that thing in the world, several years have passed. But
right.
That's nothing compared to the amount of time that can transpire between the time you write a song and when it is released on an album, right? Sometimes that's a very short amount of time, and sometimes it could be years or decades. What is the song on this album that's the oldest?
I think Nocturne is the oldest song in the sense that I can remember working on some version of that about 7-8 years ago.
And so, right, the person you were when you started writing that song, mm-hmm. is someone who we're 8 years away from.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're recording those songs, then you're almost in a different place, both
you
physically, literally, in a different place.
You absolutely are. You absolutely are. Yeah. Originally, in the before times, you know, this record was supposed to come out at the very beginning of June, and we would have been on tour all summer and that sort of thing. Then when the pandemic arrived and everyone had to adjust their plans and tours were being canceled and this, that, and the other thing, the first question for us also was, do we still release this record? And I think there's certain artists at a certain altitude, shall we say, that can pretty much be completely spontaneous or plan it way in the future or postpone indefinitely. They don't need to worry about that. At first, when we knew that we weren't going to be able to tour and we weren't going to be able to do all the normal things that one does to let the world know you have a new record out, it was like, well, let's postpone it indefinitely because we just don't know. And then it was just living with that decision for a little while. It started to not feel quite right, if only because there's a reason why you don't want to wait too long. It's like I'm very much inside this record right now. But if we were to have waited, I don't know, a year, 2 years till we can get back out on the road or whatever, I think I'd have a completely different relationship with the songs. I don't know what that would be, but I think it would be very different. And I was really happy when we decided, well, we postponed it by a month and a half or so, but it feels really good knowing that it's going to come out and stating, I think, the obvious. People need poems and songs and paintings and art and theater and all of those things, no matter what's happening in the world, if at all possible. You know, we need these things. It'll be interesting to see the works of art that are created in pandemic times and be able to see how that affects us and what we think of it all. But at any rate, I'm just glad it's not been postponed forever.
Yeah. I love that. I love that so much.
Do you remember the movie The Piano?
Yeah.
Holly Hunter plays the character in the movie, and she's deaf and she's mute. But the first thing you see or hear in the movie is her character saying, "This is me. This is my voice. I can't hear my voice, but this is my voice." She introduces herself. You hear the voice, her voice in her head, basically. And to me, there's a direct line from that to a song I wrote around that time, or after I saw that movie, called John Doe Number 24. And that was a song that I wrote after I read an obituary, and the title of the obituary said, "Unknown since 45, John Doe Number 24 takes his secret to his grave." And it was the story of this person who had been found wandering the streets of Jacksonville, Illinois. He couldn't speak. He was blind. He was deaf. He was mute. He couldn't tell anyone where he'd come from. And he became known as John Doe Number 24 because he was, at that time, the 24th unidentified person in the Illinois state mental system. And he was never able to tell anyone who he was, where he'd come from, how he ended up there. And so this obituary tried to sort of give pieces of the puzzle. He loved music. He could feel the vibrations through the floor, and he liked to play this harmonica that the nurses had given him. And there were just these, as the obituary said, I think, tantalizing clues, but again, it was never put all together. And I was just really affected by this story of this person. And I remember I tore it out paper. I carried it around in my back pocket for days, and I would show it to people, say, "Please read this. Tell me if this affects you." He never knew who he was, and no one ever knew who he was. And I think initially that made me feel like, well, he was invisible in his life. And that's just tragic, and that's terrible. But when I saw this movie, The Piano, where Holly Hunter narrates it, and we hear the voice in her head, I know that he had a voice in his head.
"I was standing on this sidewalk in 1945 in Jacksonville, Illinois. When asked what my name was, there came no reply. They said I was a deaf and sightless half-wit boy. But Lewis was my name, though I could not say it. I was born and raised in New Orleans."
And so I was able to write this song using the device of that it's him narrating it all the way through, even though he never could speak. It was him saying, "This is my story." And so I like to think that that movie influenced a song because it gave me the way in.
Absolutely.
That I didn't know how otherwise I could tell this story.
When we talk about poems, you know the thing about the word stanza?
Mm-hmm.
So the word, for people who don't know this listening, the word stanza in Italian is the word for room. And so a poem, when you say like a poem has this many stanzas, you're also saying a poem has this many rooms. And I love thinking about poems as houses. And if you think of a poem as a house that has many rooms, you can also start to think about
entrances and exits to poems. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. how do you find a way in and how do you find a way out? And so the fact that you used that phrase, a way into that song, mm-hmm. And that's what it made me think of, is that you never know what the entrance to the poem or the song is going to be.
I so agree. The way in is something that I feel like that I think of a lot when I think of certain songs, because I'd had an idea.
Right.
There was a subject that I so wanted. Like, I just wanted to write a song about X subject. But it's always been, what's the way in? If it's sort of not the most obvious thing, or you're not writing a broken heart love song. But sometimes it takes years. And it's like, and that's the thing, is there is this conceit that I was imagining things, you know, in order to tell this story. So I don't mean it in a way of trying to take liberties, but rather just trying to just tell a story somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the concept of having a topic you're trying to unlock, mm-hmm. and it isn't until you find the door. And sometimes the door is a window, and sometimes
right, exactly.
you have to go in through the basement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, last week when I was teaching a high school poetry class, uh-huh. so I was talking with these students about, like, sometimes we just use metaphor as protection, or we use the ability to talk about something that isn't what it is, so that we don't have to say in the rawest form mm-hmm. what it is. Mm-hmm. But also, not always, right? Sometimes, especially in songwriting, metaphor is like just for fun, or
right.
sometimes it's like nice to have a code where you're like, this is a song about this, but it's really a song
right.
about this, you know?
Exactly.
And it doesn't have to be
right.
protective. It can also just be, mm-hmm. you know, joyful. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on when that's a choice that has to do with the joy of the code, and when that's a choice that has to do with maybe like self-protection or distance, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about a song that might be about something that you actually need to have some distance from in order to do it, I would say Secret Keepers.
Give it up or go down with it. Secrets are both tossed on away. All these years you've been living with it, and it's fucked you up every which way. Secret keepers are lost and found. Spare a little kindness when you meet someone. You never really know what they're carrying around. Every day's a battle that's never won.
I have been trying to write this song for a very, very, very long time. With the Me Too movement, it allowed me to feel like I could find an artistic voice somehow to speak to that in my own life.
Mm.
And so it being so deeply personal, but at the same time, that is how we do what we do, is find the personal and somehow discover as we do it that the more personal something is, the more universal it is as well.
Yeah. And also that song, the way that song is framed is shared.
Mm-hmm.
Like it isn't, yes. hello, here is my personal story, right?
This is not it a is confession. This
correct,
is,
right.
This is a shared thing, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, like, both in your following the Me Too movement, and maybe hearing other people's stories, did it feel like that allowed for that entry point?
Absolutely. But even so, I have moments of, was that the right thing?
Mm.
Did I share too much? Mm. Will I regret this? You know, those are all those are the voices of doubt that we struggle with. And I'm still, I think, balancing what I need to emotionally in order to feel like that was the right choice to make to put that song on.
When I was thinking about this record, I kept thinking about how this record is incredibly courageous and incredibly vulnerable. Mm. I kept like holding those two words, or I guess the noun, courage and vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, like, were those intentional choices? Like, did you think to yourself, okay, I'm going to be courageous and vulnerable? Or is that my response to the record, and just by virtue of you being honest, that courage and vulnerability came out?
Mm. There's a lot of things in what you just said, what you just asked. I mean, I think about how I write songs and how I've always written songs, which is you write what you feel, you write what's on your mind, you write. That's when I hear other writers say, it's how I make sense of the world. It's how I order my world. It's how I navigate the world. That makes so much sense to me. That always has. It's just, yes, that's how we do, why we do what we do. That's all those things, right?
Yeah.
So it's almost like in the process, I don't think anyone is thinking, is strategically, should I put this on a record? Or to, it's like, this is what we're doing. Mm. And for me, it's just always been, well, okay, I'm writing. And then I have a moment where I feel like this feels like a work that's a whole thing. It's I don't know how you know that, but you just reach a point where you seem to know. I've just never thought, well, this is too personal, I can't put that song there. It's just because it's part of a whole thing, and I wouldn't have written the song that came after without having written the one that came before. And it would feel, somehow when I say that, it makes it sound like I've never edited myself. I guess I'm just saying that overall you have a sense of what this is, one big puzzle, or it's either a puzzle that you've putting the pieces together, here we are, metaphor, or I like this notion, it's a journey, it's a trip that you're taking, and you are trying to take the listener with you, and you go many different places. Mm-hmm. And that's what an album has always been to me. I understand, of course, that with technology, we can cherry pick the songs we want. We no longer really have to create an album, you know, air quotes. But I'm always going to be doing it that way. That's how I grew up listening to music, how I grew up taking in music. And I think it's always interesting to see where someone whose music has informed you, who you followed, it's like, what does this album say about who they are in their life? Mm-hmm. It's a snapshot. It's Secret Keepers was about trying to speak to something traumatic without being traumatized by speaking about it. Does that make sense?
Very much so. Right. How do you make art about trauma that doesn't re-traumatize both the person making it and then the person receiving it?
Right? And that's why I think I still am in that place where I wonder, well, I regret this down the road. I mean, you can't know how you feel in the future. But that said, one of the things that I feel like I've been saying for the last couple of records since I made them, just that probably the greatest thing about growing older is you don't care, right? You don't, can I say fuck on this thing? You don't fucking care anymore, you know? I mean, you care, but not about stupid things, you know, hopefully. And that's the other thing. I know that I couldn't have written this song without all these years of reflection and turning it over and upside down and trying to figure out, how do I figure out a way to talk about this space inside of myself?
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the song, Asking for a Friend, because that phrase, as I know that phrase, is almost like the perfect example of putting distance between yourself
just nailed it,
the thing you want to say.
Right.
I mean, it's the phrase that people use when they're trying to distance themselves from what they really mean, right?
Exactly.
And yeah. I like this song's use of that phrase because it's a little tongue-in-cheek, right? It's very clear right off the bat, there is no friend you're asking
right.
for yourself.
Right.
But the use of that phrase also helps us understand the kind of state of mind of this speaker, right? Like they aren't ready to have the conversation in full. They aren't ready to be as raw and vulnerable as that conversation requires. And so the deflection at the beginning is a kind of nod to that. But also I love the double meaning of you're going to be a friend soon right. when the relationship is over, quote unquote
right.
friend.
How do you tell someone it's not working? Admitting it's because of you, not them. Can silence be a crueler way to hurt? Sorry, I'm just asking for a friend.
We talked a lot about distance earlier, and so I'm curious about the writing of that song, the choosing of that phrase, how much you want it to be a wink versus how much of it is just a way of protection.
Gosh, there's so much I could tell you. There's a line in It's Okay to Be Sad that says, there's no days that are useless. And that belongs to this thing that I literally have it written out. There's no such thing as a useless day, and it's up on my kitchen. But the day I started writing, asking for a friend, I was having what I felt like was a useless day. And I'd had a number of useless days in a row. And those are the days, I mean, it will be different for everyone, but for me, when probably imposter syndrome is in charge, and I haven't been able to find my way into whatever I'm working on, I'm feeling not good. And those are the days sometimes when you're walking around lost, you're walking around in circles. And then when you go to bed that night, you feel sadly like you had a useless day. And it's a terrible feeling. It can be terrible. And then something I read smacked me in the face, and I started writing that song from an experience I had had. And really that song is really about, you know, if I'm going to say I'm the speaker, I'm the person in that song, you know, it's really just about admitting my failures as a romantic partner, as someone who's just not sure how to communicate things, the fear that goes into having to be honest with someone, the terrible fear of hurting someone, and also know that you're probably hurting yourself at the same time. There's just so much to be afraid of when you're trying to speak completely from your heart. But when I finished that song, it's exactly what I wanted to say. And it made me, again, remember there are no such things as useless days. I had no idea that this song would show up that day. On a day when I felt so acutely that way.
There's a poem by a poet named Ocean Vuong that I love very much. And I think it's called One Day I'll Love Ocean Vuong. I am not the tattooing type, but I think if I were the tattooing type, perhaps the line that I would have upon me, which I already carry in my brain at all times, is there's a line in that poem where he says, the most beautiful part of your body is where it's headed. And remember, loneliness is still time spent with the world.
Yeah.
And I think about that a lot. And the idea of like, there is no useless day. And even when you are in your loneliness, that was when this song came to you, came through you, came for you. And also the notion of like the most beautiful part of your body is where it's headed. I think there's so much in this album where you are able to look backwards and forwards while being present. That is pretty unbelievable.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I wanted to talk about the difference in a song like American Stooge and a song like Everybody's Got Something or D35 or we talked a little bit about using a metaphor to create distance between yourself and the topic. What about a song where there's no distance? You're saying you're saying what it is, who it is, what they're about, what they've done. It's not that there's no metaphor, right? Obviously, this person and this song is about much more than just the one character.
He was a small town southern boy born and bred. Credit to his hard working mother and dad. Clutch of diplomas and a uniform. Served his country, then his ship back home. Hung out a shingle, but it didn't take. He had real big dreams.
I think I always probably feel more vulnerable writing a song like Everybody's Got Something more than I would American Stooge. And the thing that's interesting also about American Stooge is that it starts out in the third person where I'm saying he did this, he did that, he did that. And then by the end of the song, it's like, I'm this, I'm that. I'm. It's like he's taken over.
I just can't lose. I'm all over the news. Batting my sweet baby blues. It's the American way. To hell with the truth. I'm sucking up to the dude. I'm an American stooge and babe. I like it that way.
When I was listening to it, I was so struck by, and I was trying to think of other songs that are wonderful songs from the perspective of villainous characters. And I was having trouble, like there's, obviously there's songs, for example, like in musical theater where a villain character is singing as themselves, like that I can summon pretty quickly. But I was trying to think of other categories of songs where it's from the perspective of a villainous character. And I was having trouble thinking of them, and I found this song to be so unique in that way.
Well, that's very cool. This song came about, I just had read too many stories about Lindsey Graham and his sucking up kind of manner. And then I was listening to a podcast about him, and he was having a moment in the media where he couldn't get away from him. We have his record in front of us when Donald Trump was running for president and Lindsey Graham was just saying he's just abhorrent. And then switcheroo, and he becomes his sycophantic right-hand guy. And they were interviewing him and he was just very, just completely at ease and unapologetic. And he was saying, you know, nothing happened to me. I just want to be relevant and I don't care who knows it. I thought it was breathtaking. I thought it sort of started out being sort of just a character study of him. But then around the time I was finishing it up, there were hearings on television. I realized there were quite a few stooges up there. And it really wasn't so much about him, but just the concept of the stooges that exist, men and women both. And so, you know, it was probably initially something to amuse myself with and just feel like, oh, okay, this is what I think. But then I realized, well, I want to put it on record. And I want it to, you know, say what I feel. I would like to describe it as a topical song. And it's hard to write a topical song without hitting people over the head with your message. And so I always want to try to not have that sledgehammer be there, but just maybe use humor or just hopefully good writing or whatever it is. And it certainly has a big, lovely groove to it too. So
yeah,
musically. So,
right. If you want, if you want people to listen to your politics, hide it in a banger.
That is the best thing I've heard in a long time.
the song Everybody's Got Something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about the speaker of that song?
Everybody's got something, babe. Everybody's dreams will someday fade. Some are wishing they were someone else. Some just wanna be by themselves. Some are trying to tear it down. Some are shaking.
Well, when I think about this record overall, I feel like that's the, it's not the title song, obviously, but it's probably the heart of the record. The speaker of that song is me, speaking to me, reminding me not to judge people, even though I know I do. Reminding me that I'm not someone's enemy, even though they may see me as that. Reminding me to remember all of those things in order to be a better person.
The fact that it's you directed to you mm-hmm. is also like another way of taking what is essentially self-reflection, self-reminder, self-interrogation, mm-hmm. and presenting it outward as something for other people to either find themselves in mm-hmm. or find permission in or find mm-hmm. guidance in, which I think is very, it's very generous, and it's also very vulnerable.
Well, one of my sisters, when I shared the record with her, we had this conversation where she said, it's eerie to me. I know you wrote these songs over the last number of years, but I'm listening to them now in the age of COVID-19 and all that has changed in our society and our lives. And I'm feeling or hearing things that speak to me from that place, which is really eerie to me. And she touched on Everybody's Got Something and the bridge sections where it says, I'm not the first, I'm not the last, and it's going to take me some time to feel like myself again. But I believe I will.
I'm not the first, I'm not the last. Worse, this will pass.
Yeah, I mean, what about the rest of this album? That's an amazing mm-hmm. point. And also, you wrote an entire album that, as you said, the songs came at different times. It's been mm-hmm. years since some of yeah. them were started. And yet also you ended up with an album that feels incredibly of this moment.
That's what I would hope for. And it does feel eerily like of this time.
Thank you for working on them. And thank you for thinking about them. And thank you for sharing the way that you think about them. Thank you for putting it into music. Thank you for giving that music to the world. Thank you for letting me probe you with questions about it for multiple hours. It's such an honor.
Thank you for being with me here. I'm so grateful for this time. Thank you.
Me too.
All these years you've been living with it, and it's fucked you up every which way. Secret keepers are lost and found. Spare a little kindness when you meet someone. You never really know what they're carrying around. Every day's a battle that's never won. It's not safe to keep.
For more from this conversation, listen to the third and final episode in this series, where we explore Mary Chapin's earliest musical influences and the incredible legacy she's built over the course of her career. One Story is produced by Jesse Baker and Eric Newsom at Magnificent Noise. Our production staff includes Hiwate Gatana, with a special thanks to Carla Sachs and Chris Tetzeli. I'm Sarah Kay. Thanks for listening.
Is it a life conveyed for a loaded gun? Out of sight, out of questions with your truest friend.